This is Icon Art Radio, and I'm here. I'm Bill Teepel, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and we're the hosts of the show, broadcasting from the Icon Gallery in the Cultural District of Fairfield, Iowa. Today's guest is Mary Snyder Behrens, and she's a wonderful person. I've gotten to really like Mary. And
thank you.
But what we really like about Mary is her wonderful work. She's showing at the gallery right now with Sue Anna Breed, and Sue Anna had seen her work at Truman State University in Missouri and had requested that Mary be the person that shows with her at this time. I had seen the work on the internet and had always been fascinated, but it wasn't until we got the works in the gallery about a week ago that I was completely entranced by the beauty of these pieces. They're on the large scale, looking at them from a distance as a whole. They're beautiful compositions, but as you approach at each level, they reveal more and more. And even up close, where you look at a tiny square inch of each painting, there's a subtlety and a aesthetic delight. And I love these things.
Thank you. Tell us.
Where to start with you? I should pass this over to Donna because she's good at launching these questions. But this body of work, the...
Drawn Conclusions?
Drawn Conclusions. Tell us about how this body of work came about.
Well, I had been doing a series of box works that started out probably around 2000. And I got that notion just driving through Iowa and looking at debris on the side of the road and knowing what I had stored in our barns and, you know, milk house and things, and thinking, I'm going to do a series called American Canvas. It's not going to have any canvas. It's just going to be, you know, the detritus that I find, you know, around our property, on our gravel roads, and combining them, you know, in such a way to make them into something. And so I started doing large box pieces, and they were about not as large as some of these, maybe 48 high, maybe 30 inches wide. And I guess a series of events happened. My mother became very ill, and I found myself driving from Iowa to Milwaukee repeatedly. You know, in a year, I would have gone back maybe 25 times. And this would happen for maybe 3 or 4 years until she died. But the works got smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the smallest ones then were things that I could, you know, focus on, you know, in a rather short period of time. And those set aside, I decided that I needed to get back into some serious work, and I was offered a show at the University of Northern Iowa. It's a large space, and I thought that this was a good opportunity to work large again. And so that's how the large pieces began. They're sort of an extension of the American Canvas pieces, but with a different theme. I had been reading a quote or an interview with an executioner, somebody who actually performed, you know, the work of the guillotine, and it turns out that even as recently as 1979, they were still beheading in France. And it wasn't the guillotine or anything like that, but the language that this man was using as he was describing this horrible thing, which he was saying was this horrible thing, the element still had such beauty. And I use words a lot as you know, kind of trigger to trigger ideas for me. And he was talking about the lunette and the bascule and things like that. And I was like, oh my God, you know, how could they call these awful things with these beautiful, beautiful words? And so I just started studying the form, and that's sort of the how I got the visual thing going in these pieces. I don't really think they have anything to do with the guillotine, but that's how that all began.
But the three sisters definitely have a connection with the guillotine.
Yeah. Well, they were the traveling maidens. They were the ones that traveled the countryside to bring the guillotine to the people. And
very democratic.
Yes. And they were always, it was a big show. I mean, not only did they take a lot of time to prepare the ground so that it was perfectly level, but they also had, bleachers. And people would come, and it was a spectator sport. And people were executed for the most minuscule offenses. It was really, really a great tragedy in human history, one of many. But yeah, those are sort of inspired about with the three traveling.
But I saw them totally aesthetically as compositions, the way they evoking the quality of material and all of these things. When I saw them, and it wasn't until we got the three up there, and you referred to it, that I realized what was going on there. I don't have those references at all with the other stuff, except for form references.
Well, I think my first priority and is always to form and composition. I think that when we're true to ourselves and we approach a work of art honestly, that which we are trying to express will come through. And I have great confidence in that. It's just a matter of having sort of a controlled expression, you know, and that's how I approach my work first.
Now, there's a consistency to all the work, like you're on a journey somewhere. When you start each piece, do you know what you're going to do with that piece, or do you just start?
I just start. And generally, I have to just make a mark, any mark, anywhere. And, in an early stage of a work, no mark is wrong, you know, because you've got no other reference. But once you do make a mark, then you have to make another mark to respond to that mark. And so, you know, then the challenge becomes, apparent. It's like juggling, you know, and you try to get as many balls in the air as you can manage, and keep them all there, you know. So for me, that's how I begin. Sometimes it's with a thing, something that I want to put in the work. And then I build the work around that. And sometimes, in the end, I end up taking the thing out. But it's sort of like the stone in the stone soup. It's something that gets you started.
Well, that's it. I love that description of, you know, you start and then the next thing relates to the first mark and the next thing has to relate to the, and they're all conversing with each other, because that's exactly what I feel in these works. They're visual conversations between every color and stripe and piece of wood. For those of you who are just listening over the air and not sitting in this wonderful room surrounded by the paintings, she has pieces of cloth, string, rope, bits of machinery, paint, pieces of metal, you know, all sorts of things are included in these works. And but there's this wonderful unity between all of these elements, and they're all as if in love with each other.
Well, I think one of the most difficult things that people who approach assemblage or collage is that they tend to want to include everything in something. Mm-hmm. And really, all the elements you include must be speaking the same language. So they have to relate to one another. And the hardest thing to do is to practice that restraint and pull back and not include everything. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like in music. It's the spaces between the notes that actually make the music. You can't fill it all up. And so that is a difficult thing, and I have a lot of work that I've gone too far, and it's destroyed because it's not going to work.
Well, and to go back to something you said earlier about the beauty of those words that were describing those awful things, and in France, what I love about your pieces is how you take these things like a rusty old part of machinery or a broken board or something like that. And you obviously have found the beauty and luminosity in that object. And then you place it in a context that allows it to have a stage, you know, and represent itself as something beautiful and not just, you know, an innard of some machine that nobody's going to see if they're just using the big machine that's included in. And so I love that element of your work, that you're you put people's attention on ordinary things and allow us to see the beauty and personality. Mm-hmm.
But it isn't the focus of the attention. I always feel that it's sort of like when you stage a play, all the actors have got to have their roles.
Right.
You know, and if you just have one star, you know, then the play falls apart. And so you have to try to create a balance between these things to incorporate those things. And and I do see the beauty in these old pieces of wood. I mean, these are things that carry this history with us that you can't possibly create yourself. You know, the rust on a nail with a little bit of paint on there. I mean, the history of that is carried with that. And that speaks to generations of people, you know, anybody who has lived in a home, you know, that or a fence, anything. They know what that is. They know what that is. And it's such a common material. But when you put it in a context that is surprising for them, they're reacquainted with it. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's part of the beauty of working with that sort of junky stuff.
That's a great description of your pieces, though, like a play, mm-hmm. characters in a play, mm-hmm. because that's exactly it. Now that once you've said that, I look at these pieces, and I actually want to sit here for 2 hours and watch this play, mm-hmm. because every time these pieces, you'll have to, whoever's listening to this on the radio should definitely come to the gallery and spend some time with these pieces, because they're many layered pieces. Like Bill was saying, you can look at them from a distance and then go close up and read them in various ways from that close distance. But they also, over a period of time, as I'm looking at the same painting, it keeps saying different things to me. It has some progression in time, it seems like, from interacting, my interaction with those characters in the painting.
Well, they're complex and restrained at the same time. I mean, they're very well worked out compositions, so that they're dense. It's like good jazz that's layered, many layered, and everything relating, but everything, there's an orderliness to that layering. And also all the pieces relate. Like, this is the Drawn Conclusions series, and it feels like one work, mm-hmm. because there's such a relationship, mm-hmm. of elements in all the works, like the repeating target and the different elements. And so I just like sitting in this room, letting my attention move around the room, and then letting it play within the works and move from one work to another and move within each work, and letting certain things reveal themselves and come forward, and then the attention moves somewhere else. And it's really quite a wonderful experience. Tell us a little bit about the ground.
There's something called floor leveling patch, and if you've ever laid down a floor, you put down your subfloor, which is your plywood, and where the joints butt up, you use this floor leveling patch, and it's a kind of a cement-based plaster. And you just trowel it on, smooth it out, so that it seals up those joints before you lay down your Duroc and your tile or whatever. And I put a new kitchen floor in, and when I was drawing the line across the plywood, you know, to mark out where I was going to be, you know, putting the tile and stuff, all of a sudden the pencil line went from this rough to this almost like, I describe it like cutting butter with a hot knife. It was drawing across this plaster, and it's like, oh my God, what a surface. And so that was something that I needed to do. So I built these boxes, and I troweled the whole surface with that floor leveling patch. And then just before it dries, you know, when it's almost perfectly dry, you can tap in, you know, lettering and stuff like that. But it takes scoring. It takes graphite. A lot of the dark painted material in here is actually roofing tar. There's very, very little actual art materials in these works. But that plaster, I don't know how permanent it is, but that's something I've never
stable.
Yeah.
It's probably
pretty stable product.
It better be if it's under your floor. It's got to hold up. That's a remarkable surface, and I learned a lot about drawing, and actually that's part of the little pun, you know, the Drawn Conclusions, because it was the graphite, the drawing of the graphite, that was the first surface, you know, that I, or the first pigment I put on the surface.
And the silvery graphite is a wonderful element in here.
And it's just number two pencil.
A Ticonderoga?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
in fact, I've got some of the old pencil stubs in some of the pieces, too. The rest of them are in a big jar, you know, that I save with all the rest of my stuff I save.
I enjoyed your analogy to actors in a play, because as I've been looking at these, I've seen a lot of artwork that's made of found objects and things, and usually it always, for me, it always has a sort of an out in the barn feeling to it, and these, in contrast, have more of a backstage in the theater feeling to me. There's a certain kind of chaotic residue left behind in the backstage parts of a theater from production after production after production. And of course, they're ultimately completely unrelated to each other. And one of them leaves a red splotch, you know, where they peeled up the masking tape. And another one leaves a piece of rope hanging from a nail. And another one had a sign, and the sign got taken down and then used for something else and put back up again. And so you get that sort of concentrated but sort of strangely concocted history in a theatrical area. And that these are, for me, very theatrical. I see them almost as sets. And I would love to see a whole set design that you would do for a play. Maybe I'll call you sometime when I'm, because I would really love to make some Beckett productions.
Oh, wow.
And these have a very compatible feeling for my sense of Beckett. You know, there's something severe about them, and there's something whimsical about them, and there's something completely unfathomable about them. And you know, the unnameable was one of Beckett's favorite things to point at, and he found, you know, innumerable ways of pointing at something that you can't say.
Well, I think too that that's something that I sort of do too, is that when I present a target, I don't give you the whole thing. You know, I try to shroud it somehow, try to pull it back. You know, so that it I'm not giving you the whole thing.
Right.
I'm making you want more or something. And that's something that I enjoy doing too. And but I also know that the target shape is also a very powerful figure, a powerful shape, and you have to be careful with circles and things like that, because that becomes the focus, you know. And so if you want to, you know, play with the whole thing again, you know, you have to allow other things to emerge.
Yeah.
I think too that one of the intriguing things for me, one of the things that keeps me going, is to try to make these seemingly disparate items work together. Things that, you know, somebody else might, you know, see them all together and say, well, this is just a mess. And I say, well, it is a mess now, but you place them this way or that way so that they start, you know, creating other kinds of, compositional similarities. And for me, that's the challenge. I grew up making puzzles, and I was always just really good at putting those things together. And I see the way that I work is often like, you know, composing a puzzle, putting pieces together and moving things around in front of me.
So. Isn't it interesting how there's this sort of innate sense of when things are in a relationship to each other, and that they can just as easily not be in a sort of correct, it's like we have a sense of correctness. When someone says something logical, you think, yeah, that makes sense. And we have a sense of composition, too, that things are somehow balanced and somehow it makes sense. And if you move that over there, then the whole thing just doesn't work anymore. And yet work is such an undefined notion of what exactly is working.
Well, you know, yeah. I think you touch on something, because I think that within us all, we have this equilibrium. You know, it's sort of like there are tones that resonate within us that are kind of, you know, classic tones, classic chords and things like that. Mm. And when, was it Socrates who was trying to show somebody, or ask this dumb barbarian child what the Pythagorean theory was, the child understood it. And it's something that we innately understand. And so I think that when people come across a composition that is working, they just know that. There's a feeling of balance within them that resonates in them.
Yeah. And I think you feel it in your body.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, you know, one thing I want you to be sure to mention before this half hour is over, you have a series of a long row of small pieces up on the mezzanine that you call your travel boxes. Mm-hmm. And you were explaining to me before the show about them. And could you say something on the air about that?
Well, the travel boxes, all these works happen concurrently. And when I was first working on the large works, I needed a release. And I was doing some of the torn paper collages, but I had these little Altoid tins, and I was, you know, playing with the notion of you know, binding them up somehow, and I played with the open tin, and it ultimately ended up being the closed tin, and then I bound them, and again, the word thing is very important to me, and I had come upon. Something Shakespeare said about the trammels of society, that she was, you know, bound by the trammels of society. And I said, what a wonderful word. And so, you know, I researched it, and I said, this is exactly what I want. This is my word, you know. And so I created these little boxes, and trammel means many things. It's actually a physical binding. They trammel horses to keep them from galloping so that they will canter. When they wrap mummies, it's called trammeling mummies. So there's a lot of things that are used for trammeling, but, like, you know, the reference with Shakespeare has to do with a kind of a societal restricting of one's duties or what is appropriate for one to do. And so I thought about those things in relationship to my life. You know, when I was growing up, being an artist was not anything that was encouraged, you know, so that was something I had to fight to do, you know, break away from those trammels, you know, and not, you know, become the grade school teacher, the school marm, or whatever. But each one of those little trammels is bound in found fabric and found pieces of string and wire, whatever. And I think they possibly could be some of my most important work. They certainly are very personal pieces, but I think they strike a more of a universal chord, because everybody does seem to relate to those. They're just sort of familiar with them upon seeing them, upon approaching them.
Yeah, they're very intimate. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're looking at something very personal, mm-hmm. possibly very private.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and mysterious.
Like, yeah, mysterious.
You want to know what's inside,
exactly.
The boxes,
right.
Mm-hmm. The
right.
Packages. And you were saying also that the particular pieces of fabric and all have a meaning to you. They mm-hmm. come from some aspect of your mm-hmm. own life. And mm-hmm. so each of those boxes is a way for you to kind of retrieve certain memories and things mm-hmm. like that.
Exactly, like almost a physical journaling of sorts.
Right.
But, you know, Proust said that, he talks about that thing called involuntary memory, where, you know, you approach something or you're in a situation and suddenly you're transported back to a memory of your own. And that's the sort of the function of art, that art it offers a window for you to search your own soul.
Beautiful.
And for me, I see that happen with the trammels more so than any other work. And that when someone approaches that, it's like they're eating that little petite madeleine and they're back in their mother's kitchen. And they're like, I know that. I know that fabric. You know, I know those knots. Those were my socks. Those were my darn socks. And for me, that kind of, because we can never anticipate how somebody is going to approach our work. We can't. We just have to do our work. But that when it does, you know, cross that bridge, you know, for somebody, for me, that's the ultimate success, you know.
Yeah, in fact, also the other effect that those boxes had on me is it made me want to go home and make them. Because there's something, look at those and you just feel that I need to do that somehow. I don't know why, you know, yeah. But it's just somehow the act of, and I guess it just, that's why we wrap presents. When we give a gift to somebody, we mm-hmm. wrap them up some. Mm-hmm. There's something about a wrapped gift or wrapped anything, you know, even a package you get in the mail, it's just in a brown thing tied with string. There's something, they go to the bakery and they tie it up and with string, there's something.
Even if you know what's in it.
Even if you
the act of opening that, yeah. you know, is yeah. always a surprise.
Yeah, it's yeah. a discovery.
Yeah.
And before it's opened, it's still, you know, it's Schrodinger's cat. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be what you think is inside.
Exactly, yeah.
It's all possibilities.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I want to do, I mean, just it's sort of a thought that flashes through my head when I see them, is I want to be inside them. I want to see that little world from the inside. And, of course, maybe it's just the inside of an Altoid box, because it hasn't been decorated on the inside, but it might have been. And then I start thinking, well, let's see, I could put a little microphone inside that and I could listen to the space inside the box. And that's probably something I'll do. Actually, recently I've been collecting containers to record the interiors of. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things about the Trammell too is its size, you know, that mm-hmm. that Altoid tin is just such a wonderful proportion, and mm-hmm. it fits so nicely in the hand, you know, and yeah. and so that's sort of a comfortable thing too, you know, something that you can carry with you. And I had a bunch of those in a show in Zurich about a year or so ago, and when they got there, they took them out of the frames and just had them naked on a platform. Mm-hmm. And you know, at first I was like, ooh, someone's going to touch them, you know, and what's going to happen if they touch them? A friend said, you know what? They should be handled. They should be carried around in people's pockets so that they develop this other patina.
That's a great idea.
You know?
Yeah.
And,
we have about a minute left.
Well, I'll just say that we've been interviewing Mary Snyder Behrens of Waterloo, near Waterloo, Iowa, who has had more than 30 solo exhibitions around the country and international exhibitions. She's quite a well-known artist in our region, and it's really our honor to have her showing in our gallery and to be on the radio today. Her show can be seen at Icon Gallery, 58 North Main, in Fairfield through April 18th, and our hours are Tuesday through Saturday, noon to 4, or by appointment. Email me, bill@icon-art.org.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.